goals of creative people, but the route each one of us travels to get there is unmarked. For me, a man who has always valued introspection, silence was a path I hadn't tried before. I've gone on a silent retreat every year since, and in addition to benefiting personally, I have done a lot of thinking about the management implications of mindfulness. If you are mindful, you are able to focus on the problem at hand without getting caught up in plans or processes. Mindfulness helps us accept the fleeting and subjective nature of our thoughts to make peace with what we cannot control. Most important, it allows us to remain open to new ideas and to deal with our problems squarely. Some people make the mistake of thinking that they are being mindful because they are focusing diligently on problems. But if they are doing so while subconsciously bound up with their worries and expectations, with no awareness that they can't see clearly or that others may know more, they aren't open at all. Similarly, within organizations, groups often hold so tightly to plans and past practices that they are not open to seeing what is changing in front of them. My thinking about this was enriched further when I happened upon a podcast of a talk given in 2011 at an annual event called the Buddhist Geeks Conference. There, a woman named Kelly McGonigal delivered a talk called What Science Can Teach Us About Practice. McGonigal, who teaches at Stanford University, discussed how recent studies of the brain's inner workings prove that the practice of meditation can lessen human suffering, not just the existential angst kind of suffering, which is bad enough, but actual physical pain. First, she talked about a study done at the University of Montreal in 2010 in which two groups, one made up of experienced Zen meditators, the other of non-meditators, were given the exact same type of pain experience, a thermal heat source strapped to one calf. They were hooked up to monitors that tracked which areas of the brain were stimulated. What researchers later discovered by looking at the brain imaging was that even though the experienced meditators weren't actively meditating in the course of the experiment, their threshold for pain was much higher than the non-meditators. The meditators' brains were paying attention to the pain, McGonigal explained, but because they knew how to turn off the inner chatter, the running commentary our untrained brains or monkey minds so happily serve up, they were better able to tolerate pain than those who did not practice meditation. Next, McGonigal cited a similar study done at Wake Forest University that focused on a group of brand new meditators who'd undergone only 4 days of training. When they were brought into the laboratory and given the same pain test, some were able to tolerate greater levels of pain than others. Why? The temptation might be to surmise that these people were simply quick studies in the art of meditation, that they were better at it than others. Brain imagery showed, however, that in fact their minds were doing the opposite of what experienced meditators' brains do. Instead of paying attention to the moment they were in, McGonigal said, they were inhibiting sensory information, somehow shifting their attention to ignore what was happening in the present moment, and that was giving rise to less suffering, inhibiting awareness rather than carefully attending to it. I found this fascinating and analogous to behavior I'd witnessed as a manager. McGonigal was talking about the brain's tendency to suppress problems instead of facing them head-on. What makes this even more difficult is that the people who were suppressing thought that they were doing the same thing as the people who were addressing the problem. It is sobering to think that in trying to be mindful, some of us accidentally end up being exactly the opposite. We deflect and ignore. And for a while at least, this behavior can even yield good results. But in the experiments McGonigal cited, People who'd made a practice of becoming mindful didn't ignore the problem at hand. In this case, the painful heat source strapped to their legs. They saw and felt it for what it was, but quieted their reaction to it, the brain's natural tendency to amplify by overthinking, and thus coped much better. This model of paying attention to what is in front of you, not hanging on too tightly to the past or the future, has proved immensely useful to me as I have tried to sort out organizational issues and to dissuade my colleagues from clinging to processes or plans that have outlived their usefulness. Likewise, the notion of acknowledging problems rather than putting in place rules that seek to suppress them has meaning to me. Ultimately, it doesn't matter if your model is different than mine. Upside-down pyramid or invisible mountain, stampeding horses or meandering sheep, what's essential is that each of us struggles to build a framework to help us be open to making something new. The models in our heads embolden us as we whistle through the dark. Not only that, they enable us to do the exhilarating and difficult work of navigating the unknown. Part 4. Testing What We Know. Chapter 12. A New Challenge. I'm thinking about selling Pixar to Disney, Steve said. To say that John and I were surprised doesn't really begin to capture it. You're what? We responded in unison. It was October 2005, and we'd just arrived at Steve's house in Palo Alto, where he lived with his wife and his three youngest kids. He'd invited us over for dinner, but suddenly neither John nor I had much of an appetite. Just 18 months before, after many fruitful years together, Disney and Pixar had had a very public falling out. Steve and Disney's chairman and CEO at the time, Michael Eisner, had abruptly halted discussions to renew our partnership agreement, and there were bad feelings all around. Specifically, we were rankled by Eisner's announcement of a new division within Disney Animation called Circle 7, which he'd created to exercise the studio's right to make sequels to our films without our input. This was hardball, an attempt to force our hand by wrenching control of our characters away from the people who'd created them. For John, it was almost as if Eisner were trying to kidnap his children. He loved Woody, Buzz, Slinky Dog, Rex, and the rest like he loved his own five sons and was heartbroken at the thought that he couldn't protect them. Now, Steve was thinking of joining forces with the company that had done this to him? In retrospect, I should say that I'd had inklings that something major might be afoot. I knew that even when Steve and Michael's relationship was at its worst, Steve still held the rest of Disney in high regard. For example, even when he didn't agree with a proposal from Disney's marketing folks, he would remind us privately that they knew more about that than he did. And Steve felt that Disney's marketing prowess, its mastery of consumer products, and its theme parks had always made it the preferred partner for Pixar, hands down. By the time Steve floated the idea of selling Pixar with John and me, I also knew that a lot had changed at Disney. Eisner was out, for one thing, having been replaced by Bob Iger. And one of Bob's first acts as CEO had been to reach out to Steve in an effort to mend fences. They'd then struck a deal to make the top shows on ABC available on iTunes, and largely because of this, Steve trusted Bob. To Steve, that deal demonstrated two things. Iger was a man of action, and he was willing to buck the knee-jerk, industry-wide trend to oppose distribution of entertainment content on the Internet. The iTunes deal took about 10 days to complete. Iger didn't let entrenched forces get in the way. But the fact remained. Circle 7 was still up and running, and still preparing to put Toy Story 3 into production without any input from us. As John and I sat there trying to get our heads around a merger, Steve began pacing around his living room, laying out the reasons that it made sense. He'd studied all the angles, of course. Number one, Pixar needed a marketing and distribution partner to get its movies into theaters around the world. Okay, that we knew already. Number two, Steve felt that a merger would help Pixar have more of a creative impact by allowing it to play on a bigger, sturdier stage. Right now, Pixar is a yacht, he said. But a merger will put us on a giant ocean liner where big waves and poor weather won't affect us as much. We'll be protected. At the end of his pitch, Steve looked us in the eye and assured us that he would not go forward with the sale unless he had both of our blessings. But he asked us to do him a favor before we made any decisions. Get to know Bob Iger, he said. That's all I ask. He's a good man. A few months later, in January of 2006, the deal went through. But Walt Disney Company's acquisition of Pixar Animation Studios for $7.4 billion was not your typical merger. Steve had made sure of that. He proposed that John and I be put in charge of both Pixar and Disney Animation. I'd be president and John chief creative officer, because he thought, and Bob agreed, that if the leadership of the two studios were separate, an unhealthy competition would emerge that would eventually drag both studios down. He also thought, frankly, that making us the stewards of both entities would guarantee that Pixar's traditions didn't get overtaken by those of the much larger corporation, the Walt Disney Company. The result was that John and I suddenly had the rare opportunity to take the ideas we'd honed over decades at Pixar and test them in another context. Would our theories about the necessity of candor, fearlessness, and self-awareness bear out in this new environment? Or were they peculiar to our own smaller shop? Figuring out the answers, not to mention how to manage two very different companies in a way that benefited both, would fall largely to John and me. John has always thought of Pixar as a studio full of pioneers who pride themselves on having invented a new art form while always aspiring to the highest level of storytelling. Disney Animation, by contrast, is a studio with a grand heritage. It's the gold standard of animation excellence. Its employees yearn to make movies that are worthy of Walt, as good as those he made, but resonant in our time. To be honest, John and I had no idea whether our theories about how to manage creative people would hold up there. The challenge was to keep Pixar healthy while making Disney Animation great again. This chapter is largely devoted to some of the ways we went about that, and it goes to the heart of one of the main reasons I wrote this book. You'll recall that my new goal after the completion of Toy Story was to figure out how to make a sustainable creative environment. Pixar's joining with Disney was our chance to prove, to ourselves if not anyone else, that what we'd created at Pixar could work outside of Pixar. Both the run-up to the acquisition and its execution provided the ultimate case study, and as such, it was enormously exciting to be a part of. First, I'll talk about how the merger came to pass in the first place, because I believe we did several things in the very early stages that put our partnership on a strong footing. Get to know Bob Iger, Steve had said. So a few weeks later, I did. We met for dinner near the Disney Studios in Burbank, and I liked him immediately. The first thing he did was tell me a story. A month earlier, at the opening of Hong Kong Disneyland, he'd had an epiphany. It happened as he was watching a parade of characters trooping by. Donald Duck, Mickey Mouse, Snow White, Ariel, and Buzz Lightyear, and Woody. It occurred to me that the only classic characters that had been created in the past 10 years were Pixar characters, Bob said. He told me that while the Walt Disney Company had many interests, from theme parks to cruise ships to consumer products to live-action films, animation would always be its lifeblood, and he was determined to see that part of the business rise again. One thing that struck me about Bob was that he preferred asking questions to holding forth, and his queries were incisive and straightforward. Something unusual had been built at Pixar, he said, and he wanted to understand it. For the first time in all the years that Pixar and Disney had worked together, someone from Disney was asking what we were doing that made our company different. Bob had already been through 2 major acquisitions in his career as an executive. When Capital Cities Communications bought the American Broadcasting Company in 1985, and when Disney bought Cap Cities ABC in 1996. One, he said, was a good experience, and the other a negative one, so he knew firsthand how destructive it could be when one culture was allowed to dominate the other in a merger. Should the Pixar acquisition go forward, he assured me, he was going to work hard not to let that happen. His agenda was clear: reviving Disney animation while also preserving Pixar's autonomy. A few days later, John had dinner with Bob, and afterward we sat down to compare notes. John agreed that Bob seemed to share our core values, but he was worried about the acquisition destroying what we held most dear, a culture of candor and freedom and the kind of constructive self-criticism that allowed our people and the movies they made to evolve into their best selves. John often likens the Pixar culture to a living organism. "It's like we found a way," he once told me, "to grow life on a planet that had never supported it before." And he didn't want anything to threaten its existence. We believed Bob had good intentions, but were wary of the larger company's ability, even inadvertently, to roll over us. Still, Bob had reassured John by indicating he wanted to work together to make sure that didn't happen. The deal was going to be expensive, he told us, and in lobbying for it with the Disney board, he was putting his own reputation on the line. Why, Bob asked, would he endanger the value of the asset Disney was buying? We had come to the fork in the road. A decision had to be made, and there were major factors to consider. What would the relationship between the studios really be? Could Pixar and Disney Animation flourish independent of one another, separate but equal? In mid-November 2005, John, Steve, and I met for dinner at one of Steve's favorite Japanese restaurants in San Francisco. As we discussed the challenges of the merger, Steve told a story. 20 years before, in the early 1980s, Apple was developing 2 personal computers, the Macintosh and the Lisa, and Steve was asked to preside over the Lisa division. It was a job he didn't want, and he admitted that he didn't handle it well. Instead of inspiring the Lisa team, he basically told them that they had already lost out to the Mac team. In other words, that their work was never going to pay off. He'd effectively crushed their spirits, he told us, and that had been wrong. Should this merger happen, he continued, what we have to do is to not make people at Disney Animation feel like they've lost. We have to make them feel good about themselves. The fact that John and I had such affection for Disney would certainly help with that. We had both spent our lives trying to live up to Walt Disney's artistic ideals, so the thought of walking through the doors of Disney Animation, entrusted with the mission of reinvigorating its people and helping them return to greatness, felt daunting but also worthy and important. By the end of dinner, the 3 of us were in agreement. the future of Pixar, of Disney, and of animation itself would be brighter if we joined forces. John and I understood that this news would come as a shock to our colleagues at Pixar. We figured that everybody would feel exactly the same as we did when Steve first floated the idea in his living room, John recalls. Before any official announcement, then, we needed to do everything we could to ensure that people felt safe and that we had taken steps to prevent change being made for the wrong reasons. With Iger's blessing, then, we set about drafting a document that came to be known as the 5-Year Social Compact. This 7-page, single-spaced list was an enumeration of all the things that had to remain the same at Pixar should the merger go through. The document's 59 bullet points addressed many topics you might expect: compensation, HR policies, vacation, and benefits. Item number 1 ensured that Pixar's executive team could still reward employees with bonuses, as Pixar has always done, once a film's box office receipts reached a certain benchmark. Others were strictly related to personal expression. Number 11, for example, stated that Pixar employees must remain free to exercise their creative freedom with their titles and names on their business cards. Number 33 ensured that Pixar's people could continue to exert personal cube/office/space decorating to reflect person's individuality. Some sought to preserve popular company rituals. Number 12. Event parties, holiday, wrap, various events are prevalent at Pixar. Various holiday parties, end-of-film parties, the annual car show, the paper airplane contest, Cinco de Mayo festivities, and the summer barbecue, to name a few. Some sought to ensure the survival of Pixar's egalitarian ethos. Number 29. No assigned parking for any employee, including executives. All spaces are first come, first served. We couldn't say for sure that these items we sought to safeguard were what had propelled us to such success, but we felt strongly about them and we were going to work hard to prevent them from changing. We were different, and since we believe being different helps us maintain our identity, we wanted to remain that way. There was one other important factor that shaped the deal that was not reported at the time. It related to the issue of trust. As we were finalizing the merger, Disney's board of directors didn't like the fact that key Pixar talent was not under contract. If Disney bought us, and then John or I or certain other leaders left the company, they felt it would be a disaster, so they asked that we all sign contracts before the deal went through. We declined. It is a tenet of the Pixar culture that people should work there because they want to, not because a contract requires them to. And as a result, no one at Pixar was under contract. But even though this rejection was based on a core belief, it made the deal feel questionable for Disney. On the Pixar side, meanwhile, there was considerable concern that the Disney bureaucracy would inadvertently destroy what we had built. Both sides then felt at considerable risk. The result, though, was that at the heart of this merger was an understanding that both companies had to trust each other. Each side felt a personal obligation to live up to the intent of the agreement, and I believe this was the ideal way to begin our relationship. On the day of the sale, Bob flew up to Pixar's headquarters in Emeryville near Oakland for the announcement, and once the documents were signed and the stock exchanges were notified, Steve, John, and I walked out onto a stage at the far end of Pixar's atrium and greeted all 800 of our employees. This was a crucial moment for the company, and we wanted our colleagues to understand its genesis and how the deal would work. One by one, John, Steve, and I spoke about the thinking behind the deal, how Pixar needed a strong partner, how this was a positive step in our evolution, and how determined we were, despite the changes, to protect our culture. Looking out into the faces of our colleagues, I could see that they were upset, as we knew they would be. We too were emotional. We loved our colleagues and the company they'd built, and we knew how big a change we were setting in motion. We welcomed Bob onto the stage then, and our people greeted him with a warmth that made me proud. Bob told the Pixar staff exactly what he'd told us, that he loved the work we did, first of all, but also that he'd been through one bad merger and one good one in his life, and he was determined to do this right. "Disney Animation needs help, so I have two options," he said. "One, to leave the place in the hands of the people who are already in charge, or two, to go to people who I trust, who have a proven track record of making great stories and characters that people love. That's Pixar. I promise you that the culture of Pixar will be protected." Later, in an hour-long conference call with analysts, Steve and Bob moved to make good on that promise. They announced that Circle 7 would be shut down. "We feel very strongly," Steve said, "that if the sequels are going to be made, we want the people who were involved in the original films involved." It was the end of the day before John, Steve, and I had a chance to take a breath, heading upstairs and ducking into my office. The minute the door shut behind us, Steve put his arms around us and began to cry. Tears of pride and relief, and frankly, love. He had succeeded in providing Pixar, the company he'd helped turn from a struggling hardware supplier into an animation powerhouse, with the two things it needed to endure: a worthy corporate partner in Disney, and in Bob, a genuine advocate. The next morning, John and I flew to Disney headquarters in Burbank. There were hands to shake and executives to meet, but our main purpose that day was to introduce ourselves to the 800 men and women who worked at Disney Animation and to assure them that we came in peace. At 3 o'clock, we walked over to Soundstage 7 on the Disney backlot, a cavernous space that was packed with animation employees standing shoulder to shoulder. Bob spoke first. He said that the acquisition of Pixar should not be seen as a sign of disrespect to Disney's ranks, but rather as proof of how deeply he loved animation and saw it as Disney's core business. When it was my turn to speak, I kept it brief. I told my new colleagues that a company could only be great if its employees were willing to speak their minds. "From that day forward," I said, "every Disney Animation employee should feel free to talk to any colleague, regardless of position, and not be afraid of repercussions." This was a central tenet at Pixar, though I was quick to add that this would be one of the few times that I would import an idea from Emeryville without discussing it with them first. "I want you all to know, I do not want Disney Animation to be a clone of Pixar," I said. I was eager to turn the microphone over to John, the kindred spirit whom so many of the artists in the room already revered. I sensed that John's presence would reassure them about the transition, and I was right. John gave an impassioned speech about the importance of story and character development, and how both got better when artists and filmmakers worked together in a culture of mutual respect. He talked about what it meant to be a director-driven animation company that made movies that sprung from people's hearts and connected in a real way with audiences. Judging by how the Disney employees were cheering, I gathered that, just as Steve had requested, John and I didn't make them feel like they'd lost the battle. Years later, I would ask the director, Nathan Greenough, who had been at Disney Animation for a decade when we arrived, what was going through his mind that morning when the merger was announced. "Here's what I thought," he told me. "I thought, maybe now the Disney I wanted to work for when I was a kid will come back." My first day in Burbank, I arrived at Disney Animation before 8 in the morning. I wanted to walk the halls before anyone else got there, just to get the lay of the land. I arranged to meet Disney's facilities manager, Chris Hibbler, for a tour. We started in the basement, and the first thing I noticed was the strange lack of personal items on employees' desks. At Pixar, people's work areas are virtual shrines to individuality, decorated, adorned, modified in ways that express the quirks and passions of the person who occupies that space. But here the desks were sterile, cookie-cutter, utterly without personality. When I first mentioned this to Chris, he muttered something evasive and kept moving. It was so stark that I brought it up again a few minutes later, and again he demurred. As we headed up the stairs into the heart of the building, I turned and asked Chris directly why it was that people in such a creative environment didn't personalize any part of their work areas. Was there a policy against it? The place looked, I said, as if no one spent any time there. At this point, Chris stopped and faced me. In anticipation of my arrival, he confided, everybody had been told to clean off their desks in order to make a good first impression. This was an early indication of how much work lay ahead of us. For me, the alarming thing wasn't the lack of tchotchkes. It was the pervasive sense of alienation and fear that the total lack of individuality represented. There seemed to be undue emphasis put on preventing errors. Even when it came to something as small as office decor, no one dared to put themselves out there or to make a mistake. That sense of alienation was also reflected in the design of the building itself. Its layout seemed to impede the collaboration and exchange of ideas that Steve, John, and I believed was so fundamental to creative work. Employees were spread out over 4 floors, which made it a chore to drop in on one another. The bottom 2 floors were dungeon-like, with dreary, dropped ceilings, very few windows, and almost no natural light. Instead of inspiring and fostering creativity, it could hardly have felt more stifling and isolating. Upstairs, on the top floor, the executive suite was set off by an imposing portal that discouraged entry, creating a sort of gated community kind of vibe. To put it simply, it struck me as a lousy work environment. One of our most pressing orders of business, then, would be some basic remodeling. First, we turned the off-putting executive suite on the top floor into 2 spacious story rooms where filmmakers could gather to brainstorm about their films. John and I put our offices on the 2nd floor, right in the middle of things, and removed the secretarial cubicles that had functioned as a sort of obstacle to access. Instead, most secretaries got their own offices. John and I made a point of leaving the shades on our office windows open so that people could see us and we could see them. Our goal, in our words and our actions, was to communicate transparency. Instead of a portal separating us from them, we installed a carpet whose brightly colored panels, like lanes of a road, guided people toward our offices, not away from them. We ripped out several walls to create a central gathering place right outside our doors, complete with a new coffee and snack bar. These may sound like symbolic or even superficial touches, but the messages they sent set the stage for some major organizational changes. And there were many more to come. I told you in Chapter 10 how we eliminated the oversight group that was charged with poring over production reports to make sure that films were progressing as expected, but really just ended up eroding staff morale. Unfortunately, that group was just one of several hierarchical mechanisms that were impeding creativity at Disney Animation. We tried as best we could to take each of them on, but at first, I'll admit it felt like an uphill climb. Since we didn't know much of anything about the people, the directors, or the projects at Disney, we had to do a quick audit. John and I asked to be briefed on each film that was underway, and I interviewed every one of the studio's managers and leaders, producers, and directors. In truth, I couldn't deduce much from those interviews, but they weren't wasted time. Since John and I were perceived as the new sheriffs in town, it was good to prove that I was human just by sitting there talking. Overall, we knew that the studio's way of thinking about films wasn't working, but we didn't know if that was because its leaders lacked ability or if they were just trained poorly. We had to start by assuming that they'd inherited bad practices and that it was our job to reteach them. This led us to look for people who were willing to grow and learn. But this is the kind of thing that you can't ascertain quickly, and there were about 800 people to assess. Nonetheless, we moved forward with a strategy. We needed to create a version of the Brain Trust and teach the studio's people how to work within it. While the directors liked each other, each movie at Disney had been set up to compete for resources, so they were not bonded as a group. In order to create a healthy feedback loop, we'd have to change that. We had to figure out who the actual leaders within the studio were. That is, not assume the people in the biggest offices were leading. It was clear that there was internal contention between productions and between technical groups. As far as I could tell, the contentiousness grew out of misconceptions rather than anything substantive. We needed to fix that. We made the decision early on that we would keep Pixar and Disney Animation completely separate. This was a critical decision that was not obvious to most people. Most people assumed that Pixar would do 3D movies and Disney would do 2D, or they assumed that we would merge the two studios or mandate that Disney use the Pixar tools. But the key to us was separation. John and I began shuttling back and forth at least once a week from Emeryville to Burbank. At first, Pixar's CFO joined us to help think through and implement procedural changes, and one of our technical leaders helped Disney reform its technical group. Other than that, we did not allow either studio to do any production work for the other. With these strategies in place, we could dive into figuring out what to do. One top executive at Disney got my attention right away by telling me that he didn't know why Disney had bought Pixar in the first place. Apparently a lover of sports analogies, he told me that Disney Animation was on the 1-yard line ready to score. He felt Disney was on the verge of fixing its own problems and finally ending its 16-year fallow period without a single number one film. I liked this guy's moxie and his willingness to push back, but I told him that if he were to continue at Disney, he needed to figure out why, in fact, Disney was not on the 1-yard line, not about to score, and not about to fix its own problems. This executive was smart, but over time I realized that to ask him to help dismantle a culture he had built was too much, so I had to let him go. He was so fixated on existing processes and the notion of being right that he couldn't see how flawed his thinking was. In the end, the person I turned to for leadership was the person many assumed I would let go right off the bat, the head of Circle 7, Andrew Milstein. Most people thought that John and I would automatically view anybody associated with those Pixar sequels as tainted, but in truth, that didn't even occur to us. The Circle 7 people had nothing to do with the decision to make sequels to Pixar films. They were just hired to do a job. When I sat down with him, Andrew struck me as thoughtful and eager to understand the new direction we were headed in. Our filmmakers had lost their voices, he told me, summing up the problem. It wasn't that they had no desire to express themselves, But there was an imbalance of forces in the organization, not just within it, but between it and the rest of the corporation, that diminished the validity of the creative voice. The balance was gone. It's easy to see that Andrew spoke my language. This was someone I could work with. Eventually, we'd make him general manager of the studio. Another lucky break for us was that our head of human resources at Disney Animation was Anne LeCam. Even though she was steeped in the old ways of doing things, Anne had an intellectual curiosity and a willingness to remake the animation studio in a different image. She became my guide to the inner workings of Disney while I encouraged her to think in new ways about her job. For example, not long after I arrived, she sat down in my office and presented me with a 2-year plan that laid out exactly how we should manage various staffing issues going forward. The document was specific about targets we would reach and when we would reach them. It was meticulous. She'd spent 2 months preparing it, so I was gentle when I told her it wasn't what I wanted. To show her what I wanted, I drew a pyramid on a piece of paper. "What you have done in this report is to assert that in 2 years we will be here," I said, putting my pencil lead at the top of the pyramid. "Once you assert that, though, it's human nature that you will focus only on making it come true. You will stop thinking about other possibilities. You will narrow your thinking and defend this plan because your name will be on it and you will feel responsible." Then I started drawing lines on the pyramid to show how I'd prefer she approach it. The first line I drew represented where we would aim to go in 3 months. The next one represented where we might be in 3 more, and you'll note that it didn't stay within the boundaries of Anne's 2-year plan. "Chances are," I said, "we would end up somewhere other than the top of the pyramid she'd imagined, and that was as it should be. Instead of setting forth a perfect route to achieving future goals and sticking to it unwaveringly, I wanted Anne to be open to readjusting along the way, to remaining flexible, to accepting that we would be making it up as we go." Not only did she intuitively grasp what I was talking about, she also soon undertook a painful reorganization of her own group to align it with the new way of thinking. Some things that needed fixing at the studio were glaringly obvious. For example, as we talked to Disney directors, we discovered that they were used to receiving 3 sets of notes on their films. One came from the studio's development department, another from the head of the studio, and a third from Michael Eisner himself. The notes were not, in fact, notes. They were mandatory, delivered as a list with boxes next to each item. Boxes that had to be checked as each note was executed. Even worse, none of the people who were giving these notes had ever made a film before, and the 3 sets of notes often conflicted with one another, creating a sort of schizophrenic quality to the feedback. This concept, completely counter to what we believed and practiced at Pixar, could only result in an inferior product. So we made an announcement. From that day forward, there would be no more mandatory notes. Disney Animation's directors needed a feedback system that worked, so we immediately set about helping them create their own version of the Brain Trust, a safe arena in which to solicit and interpret candid responses to developing projects. This was made easier by the fact that they already liked and trusted each other. Even before our arrival, we were told, they'd formed their own under-the-radar group called the Story Trust, but the lack of management understanding for that concept had prevented it from evolving into a coherent forum. As soon as possible, we flew about a dozen Disney directors and story people up to Pixar to observe a Brain Trust session about Brad Bird's Ratatouille. However, John and I told them they were only allowed to observe, not participate. We wanted them to be flies on the wall, to see how different things could be when people felt free to be candid and when notes were offered in the spirit of helpfulness rather than derision. The next day, several Pixar directors, writers, and editors accompanied the Disney crew back down to Burbank to observe a story trust meeting on a film in the works there called Meet the Robinsons. Here, too, we insisted that the Pixar team observe quietly, saying nothing. I thought I noticed a bit more ease in the room that day, as if the Disney people were cautiously feeling for the limits of their new freedom, and the producer of the film later told me it was the most constructive note session she had ever seen at Disney. Still, both John and I sensed that while everyone embraced the idea of organized candor on an intellectual level and could begin to approximate it when instructed, it would be a while before it came naturally. A key moment in this evolution came in the fall of 2006, 9 months after the merger, at a Story Trust meeting in Burbank. It happened after a fairly awful screening of American Dog, a film structured around a famous and pampered canine actor, think Rin Tin Tin, who believed that he was the superhero character he played on TV. When he found himself stranded in the desert, he had to face for the first time how his tidy, scripted life had not prepared him for reality, that he, in fact, had no special powers. That was all well and good, but somewhere along the way, the plot had also come to include a radioactive, cookie-selling Girl Scout zombie serial killer. I'm all for quirky ideas, but this one had metastasized. The movie was still finding its way, to say the least, so John started off the meeting, as he often does, by focusing on the things he liked about it. He also indicated he saw some problems, but he wanted to give the Disney folks the chance to take the lead on those, so instead of digging in and getting too specific, he threw the meeting open to the floor. Throughout the meeting, the comments stayed at a superficial level, remaining largely upbeat. Judging by the commentary, you would have never known the film was in disarray. Afterward, one of the Disney directors confided to me that many people in the room had major reservations about the film, but didn't say what they thought because John had kicked things off so positively. Taking their cues from him, they didn't want to go against what they thought he liked. Not trusting their own instincts, they held back. John and I immediately arranged a dinner with the directors and told them that if they ever resorted to that kind of thinking again, we'd be finished as a studio. Disney Animation was sort of like a dog that had been beaten again and again, Byron Howard, the director, told me when I asked him to describe the mindset back then. The crew wanted to succeed, but they were afraid of pouring their hearts into something that wasn't going to succeed. You could feel that fear. And in notes meetings, everyone was so afraid of hurting someone's feelings that they held back. We had to learn that we weren't attacking the person, we were attacking the project. Only then could we create a crucible that boils away everything that's not working and leaves the strongest framework. Earning trust takes time. There's no shortcut to understanding that we really do rise and fall together. Without vigilant coaching, pulling people aside who didn't speak their minds in a particular meeting, say, or encouraging those who seem eternally hesitant to jump into the fray, our progress could have easily stalled. Telling the truth isn't easy. But I can say that today, Disney's Story Trust is made up of individuals who understand not only that they must do the difficult work of leveling with one another, but how to do it better. In those first months, we also moved to bolster trust within the studio in another way. Just as we had refused to sign employment contracts, we now move to eliminate contracts for everyone. At first, many people thought the move was an attempt to wrest power away from the employees and give them less security. In fact, my feeling about employment contracts is that they hurt the employee and the employer. The contracts in question were one-sided in favor of the studio, resulting in unexpected negative consequences. First and foremost, there was no longer any effective feedback between bosses and employees. If someone had a problem with the company, there wasn't much point in complaining because they were under contract. If someone didn't perform well, on the other hand, there was no point in confronting them about it. Their contract simply wouldn't be renewed, which might be the first time they heard about their need to improve. The whole system discouraged and devalued day-to-day communication and was culturally dysfunctional. But since everybody was used to it, they were blind to the problem. I wanted to break that cycle. I believed that it was our responsibility to make sure that Disney Animation was a place that people would want to work. If our most talented people could leave, then we would have to be on our toes to keep them happy. When someone had a problem, we wanted it to be brought quickly to the surface, not to fester. Most people know that they don't get their way on everything, but it is very important that they know they are being dealt with straightforwardly and that they too will be heard. As I have said, we decided early on that Pixar and Disney Animation should remain completely separate entities. What this meant was that neither would do any production work for the other, no matter how pressing the deadlines or how dire the situation. No exceptions. Why? Because mixing the two staffs would have been a bureaucratic nightmare. But there was an overarching management principle at work as well. Simply put, we wanted each studio to know that it could stand on its own and solve its own problems. If we made it easy for one studio to borrow people or resources from the other to help solve a problem, the upshot would be that we'd mask the problem. Not allowing such borrowing was a conscious choice on our part to force problems to the surface where we could face them head on. Almost immediately, we had a crisis on Ratatouille that would severely test this policy. I mentioned earlier that we switched directors on this film midstream, bringing in Brad Bird, fresh off The Incredibles, who came in and reworked the story in ways that required a serious technical reboot. Specifically, while in the earlier version all the rats had walked on 2 feet, Brad felt strongly that, with the exception of Remy, our hero, they should walk on 4, like real rats. What that meant was that the rat's rigging, a set of complex controls that let animators manipulate the shape and position of the computerized model, had to be changed significantly. Finding themselves way behind schedule, the production team at Pixar felt that it did not have the resources to do the re-rigging that Brad's four-footed decision required. The producer said that they couldn't finish the film by the deadline unless they could borrow some people from Disney, which was in a lull between projects, to help out. We said no, not an option. We had already explained the logic to everybody, but I suppose they wanted to see if we really meant it. I can't blame them. Getting extra people was easier than having to solve the problems. But in the end, the Ratatouille team figured out how to make the film, on time, with what they had. Not long after, Disney would have a crisis of its own on American Dog. I mentioned earlier the emergence of a serial killer storyline which, while we prided ourselves on always remaining open to new ideas, seemed a tad dark for a family film. Despite our misgivings, though, we decided to give the movie a chance to evolve. Finding a movie's through line always takes time, we told ourselves. But after 10 months of story trust meetings and very little improvement, we concluded that the only option was to restart the project. We asked Chris Williams, a veteran story artist best known for Mulan and The Emperor's New Groove, and Byron Howard, then a supervising animator on Lilo and Stitch, to step in as its directors. Immediately, they began reconceiving the movie. The serial killer was tossed, and the movie was renamed Bolt. One of the biggest problems they felt was that Bolt himself wasn't appealing enough visually to carry the film. He just wasn't ready, Byron recalled, adding that right before Christmas 2007, we had a This Dog Looks Bad meeting where we said, "What the hell are we going to do about it?" And two of our animators stepped forward and over their Christmas break worked with our riggers to redo the dog. They spent their whole 2-week vacation here, but when we came back, Bolt had gone from 20% appealing to 90% appealing. With much to do and little time to do it, Bolt's producer Clark Spencer asked if they could borrow some Pixar production people. Again, John and I said no. It was important, we felt, for each studio to know that when they finished a film, nobody had bailed them out. They'd made it themselves. Chris later told me that to be at the helm of a production whose crew showed this kind of commitment under such pressure was energizing. It was amazing to find myself in the middle of this thing that was so galvanizing for the whole studio, he recalled. In my 15 years at Disney, I'd never seen people work so hard and complain so little. They were really invested in this thing. They knew it was the first movie under John, and they wanted it to be great. Which was good, because, as it turned out, yet another crisis was looming. Very late in the game, problems arose around Rhino the hamster, our hero's trusty, if deluded, sidekick and the funniest character in the movie. At the beginning of 2008, with only months left to go on the production, the animators reported that Rhino was proving prohibitively time-consuming to animate. The problem was, ironically, sort of the inverse of the one Pixar had on Ratatouille. The rebooted script required Rhino to be able to walk on two legs, but he'd originally been designed to walk on four, which doesn't sound like a big deal. But animating a two-legged character with a four-legged rigging design is extremely difficult to pull off without the character appearing distorted. This was a major setback. Rhino was key to the humor and exposition of the film, but the animators said that he was so hard to animate that it was impossible for them to finish on time. Desperate, we turned for help to the film's technical directors and asked if they could simplify the character's rigging to make it easier to animate. Their answer? Re-rigging would take 6 months, which was all the time we had left to make the movie. In other words, we were screwed. John and I called a company-wide meeting. We explained the situation, and I gave what some at Disney still call the Toyota speech, in which I described the car company's commitment to empowering its employees and letting people on the assembly line make decisions when they encountered problems. In particular, John and I stressed that no one at Disney needed to wait for permission to come up with solutions. What is the point of hiring smart people, we asked, if you don't empower them to fix what's broken? For too long, a culture of fear had stymied those who wanted to step outside of Disney's accepted protocols. That kind of timidity wasn't going to make Disney animation great, we said. Innovation would, and we knew they had it in them. We challenged them to step up and help us fix this problem. After this meeting, three members of the crew took it upon themselves over the weekend to remodel and re-rig Rhino. Within a week, the project was back on track. Why was a problem that took a few days to solve originally projected to take 6 months? The answer, I think, lay in the fact that for too long, the leaders of Disney Animation placed a higher value on error prevention than anything else. Their employees knew there would be repercussions if mistakes were made, so the primary goal was never to make any. To my mind, that institutional fear was behind the Bolt re-rigging snafu. With the best intentions, the film's production managers had responded to the crisis with a timetable that would ensure a character that was fully functional with no errors. The irony is that if a solution only takes a few days to find, then you don't care so much if there are errors because you will have plenty of time to fix them. But seeking to eliminate failure was in this instance, and I would argue most instances, precisely the wrong thing to do. In order for three people to decide to get together offline and dream up solutions, we had to install an ethos at Disney Animation that made that behavior okay, whether or not they were successful. That ethos had been at the studio once, but it was sadly absent when we arrived. It was nothing short of exhilarating to see it come back full force on Bolt. Chris and Byron and their creative team were open and responsive and, most important, able to move the focus away from the notion of the right way to fix the problem to actually fixing the problem, a subtle but important distinction. Even before Bolt opened to positive reviews and solid box office, the impact of these internal victories had reinvigorated the ranks of Disney Animation. By pulling together, they'd turned a humdrum, stalled project into a compelling one, and in record time. By early 2009, when the film received an Oscar nomination for Best Animated Feature Film, it felt like a bonus. It's difficult sometimes to tell the difference between what is impossible and what is possible but requires a big reach. At a creative company, mistaking one for the other can be fatal, but getting it right always elevates. At Disney, Bolt was the movie that proved this truth. We were part of the way there. It's not often talked about, but after the merger, there was some discussion of shutting Disney Animation down altogether. The argument for doing so, expressed by Steve Jobs, among others, was that John and I would be spread too thin to do a good job at both places, and that we should focus our energies on keeping Pixar strong. But John and I dearly wanted the opportunity to help revive Disney Animation, and Bob Iger supported us in that goal. We believed, in our souls, that the studio could be golden again. Still, Steve's worry about our stamina, or, put another way, about our inability to be in two places at once, wasn't unfounded. We had only so many hours in each day, and Pixar would, by definition, be getting less of them than it once had. From the moment the merger was announced, John and I had attempted to ease our colleagues' fears by hosting several get-togethers for anyone who wanted to hear more about why we thought the merger made sense. Still, as we began to spend more time at Disney, the general feeling at Pixar, which many people articulated to John and me directly, was that our reduced presence in Emeryville and our focus on Burbank's needs was a bad sign for the company. One Pixar manager likened the situation to the aftermath of a divorce when your parents remarry and adopt the kids of their new spouses. We feel like we're the original kids and we've been good, but the adopted kids are getting all the attention, he told us. We're being punished, in a sense, for needing less help. I didn't want Pixar to feel neglected, but I'll admit I saw an upside to this new reality. Namely, it was an opportunity for other Pixar managers to step forward. Given how long John and I had been there,